Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. And welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with New Orleans mystery writer Jean Redman, author of Girl on the Edge of Summer and Perdition. We'll also hear from Ada Calhoun, whose new essay collection is Wedding Toast, I'll Never Give. Jean Redman is one of the hardest working writers in town. She has a demanding day job as the director of prevention for the No AIDS Task Force, and today we're celebrating the release of her 10th and 11th mysteries. The first is the ninth in her series, written as J.M. Redman, featuring private investigator Mickey Knight, a series which has won several Lambda Awards. The new book is called The Girl on the Edge of Summer. I love that title. The other is the second in the series she writes as R. Jean Reed. It features a small-town newspaper editor, Nell McGraw, and it's called Perdition. Jean Redman, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's always good to be on The Reading Life.
So it's been a while since we've seen Mickey Knight. So what was it like to go back to this character?
She's always kind of an interesting character because I deliberately made her pretty flawed and messed up. That's the polite radio term for it. So she's interesting to deal with. And there are a lot of ways that, you know, as a private investigator, things can just walk in her door. So it's always kind of fun. People are like, well, you're doing this other series now, so you're not going to write any more Mickey Knight books. And it's like, no, there are other stories I wanted to tell with these series that I really could not with Mickey Knight.
Right. Totally different openings. Yeah. And you're right. She's kind of a sitting duck in that office. Anybody can walk through
yes.
the door.
Mm-hmm.
And people do in this one. And she yes. has very different cases to solve in this
yes.
book.
Yes, she does. And they parallel each other in certain ways. And I wasn't going to do anything really obvious, like have an actual, oh, there's some sort of weird connection, because that's just pushing coincidence too far. But I wanted them to echo each other.
And one draws from historical records. It's
yes.
a very different kind of case. Was that a fun thing to write for you?
Yeah. And one of the things I really tried to do in this book, you know, because it's always been first person. And this is sort of the writer as opposed to the reader. In this book, if you notice, I am, instead of just being first person only, I have moved into other characters' voices. And so
right.
we hear other characters and what they're thinking and what they're feeling. And so it becomes a kind of a different narration than the previous books, because the other ones were just, they were all Mickey Knight in her head, first-person narrative. This one obviously moves into, you know, fortunately for her, unlike most historians, she actually can find stuff that she needs in the archives because I can make them up. And so she's been asked to solve a murder that took place in 1906 during the height of Storyville. And it's not likely that she'll find it, but she goes back to the archives and starts looking for it. And then again, you know, looking at what are the parallels, what was happening back then that's still happening today, and how are we as a society kind of dealing with these issues?
I love it. I love it whenever anyone refers to my friendly archivist.
Yes.
they're so underrated. They deserve to be appreciated in novels.
Yes, yes, they do.
Now, Mickey's having a bit of a hard time these days. She's recovering
well,
from...
she always is.
She is. That's true. But she's recovering from heartbreak. And,
yeah.
And she's dipping her toes into the online dating world.
Yes, she is.
Now, I think those scenes must have been hilariously fun to write.
Well, yes. I mean, as we know, there are a lot of people out in the world that are good, kind, smart, but there are some that are not. You know, and I sort of joke that, you know, when you're in your 40s, you're trying to date, or 50s, you know, I mean, she's in her 40s in the books. It's like all the good people have already been taken. They got snapped up, you know, in the 20s and 30s. And so suddenly you're dealing with the pot of losers. Wait till you're in your 60s, man. It's bad. It's just
yeah,
bad.
Then you start going, okay, they're looking at the cancer wards and who's died and who's left. That's a horrible thing to say. But no, it's that quest. And you know, even when you're young, it's still hard to find that person you can connect to, that person you feel you can walk along the street with, that you can, you know, cook your dinners and hang out and just have that companionship with. And it gets harder as you go along. And obviously, in many ways, online dating is just an evolution. Because if you go back, again, you go back to the archives, you can find in the classified ads back in the 1800s, the 1900s, people looking for marriage, looking for this sort of stuff. I'm sure there are probably newspapers that you could look for the other things that people look for these days as well. But it's always been that if your social circle doesn't introduce you to people that you find companionable, how do you meet them? And online is the latest version of that.
Well, Mickey's date with the girl with the Hummer will live on forever.
Yes. Just great.
So when will we see Mickey again? Are you jazzed up to write the next one now?
Yes, I am. I'm actually doing something really weird for me. I'm working on two books.
Whoa,
I'm working on the next Nell McGraw book. Midnight Inc. wants to bring out the next one, so I have a contract for that. And I'm also, you know, I've had some ideas for the Mickey Knight book, and I'm thinking, well, I might as well start putting them down on the page. And writing a novel particularly is just, you do it day after day, after a week, after a month, after 2 weeks away from it because you had to travel for your work and this sort of stuff, and then you get back to it. So it's just sit down and do it, you know. They're a good excuse not to clean the house.
I'm always looking for one of those.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Perdition, the new Nell McGraw book. Uh-huh. This book just kept me turning pages like crazy because I was so worried about everybody in it. And here's a small town, which we think is, you know, sweet and ideal and safe. And children are disappearing.
Yes. Well, I've tried to make it not such a small town. I tried to make it not really a Cabot Cove, so to speak.
Right.
And it's based very loosely on where I grew up, on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And if you know the Mississippi Gulf Coast, you know it's really just a fairly long strip of populated areas. So this is kind of one of the smallish towns. I'm guessing it's got about 50,000 people in it. And the paper serves the county. It serves the local area. So it's, you know, we're looking at a couple hundred thousand people that could potentially be in its purview, per se. So I didn't want it to be really, really small, tiny town, because that becomes like, wait, how many people are dropping dead here?
How many are left?
Yeah, exactly. It's like there's, you know, Chicago, New Orleans, and Cabot Cove have the highest murder rates in America. Yeah, because I write fairly, I consider, darker books, more noir books. I'm not a cozy. I'm not a, you know, I try and have a little bit of humor in the books, but it's not the purpose of the books. And so this was, you know, what are the kind of stakes? What would hit this newspaper editor in this part in her life? What's going on with her? And how do I make this, you know, a story with some pretty high stakes in it?
And she's a widow. Her husband was the editor of the paper.
Right.
Nell has stepped in to take over the paper. Yeah. So she's got a balancing act.
Right.
Like nobody's business.
Yes. You know, to me, that's the interesting thing. You know, the stories that we write that we want to read are the ones about people in their transitions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not at a set place in their life. They're not at, you know, the happily ever after marriage, you know, companionship, that sort of stuff. They are at that transition. And, you know, one of the interesting things to me about Nell is the way the series sets up is that she had married Tom McGraw. You know, they'd met in journalism school. She was a Yankee from Indiana. He's this boy from Mississippi. They came back to run his grandfather's paper that he started. And this was the life she'd planned. You know, she was going to be with him. They have two children. And then suddenly he was killed by a drunken driver. And what does she do? How does she deal with this huge upheaval in her life? You know, she's been the kind of outsider. Again, you know, she's a Yankee. She's not from there. She's not from this small town. She doesn't have those connections. And you know what it's like. It's like, where did you go to high school?
Right.
You know, where do you go to church? All these different things that make up the connections in a small town. And in a lot of ways, she doesn't have these. And so it's her journey. How does she start to navigate this new world for her?
And in addition to that, she's got this mother-in-law who's not particularly kind to her. She has these kids who are at difficult ages and grieving over their father. And yet she has power in the town, and she feels a responsibility to the town very keenly.
Uh-huh. The small town paper is the one, particularly these days, you can get so much news, but it's all, you know, what's happening with the presidency, what's happening internationally. It's, you know, what happened to, you know, Mrs. Jones' lost dog is... where do you get it? You know, so in a small town paper, particularly for that, this is where people get
You know, if you're running for the alderman position or the councilman or whatever, this is the one place you can get the, that kind of news. And it does give you a fair amount of power, I think, to control what is known, how is the story presented. You know, oftentimes we don't think about these things. We look at journalism as, well, these are the facts. And good journalism, yes, they are. But it's always, who's looking for the facts? What facts are they finding? How are they telling the story? And I want to make her kind of aware of that, how she's telling the story and how much influence and how much power that kind of story can have and how it can affect the people around her in sometimes not so pleasant ways.
And then there's the balancing of an eccentric staff. Where,
yes.
You know, cooking column is very important in a small town newspaper.
Oh, you betcha it is.
And editing those are, you know, that's very difficult, I think.
Well, I wanted to make it real. I mean, you know, what are the real people? And, you know, one of the fascinating things to me in life is that we are such flawed characters, and yet when we all work together, even with our flaws, sometimes we can create incredible things. You know, I mean, I work for a healthcare facility that is now a large community clinic.
Right.
And, you know, we're all flawed people. We don't always get along. We don't always agree. But we're doing a lot of services for the community. And the same thing, I think, with the newspaper. It's okay. So you've got the Ina Claire who does the cooking column. Well, she also does the classifieds. And so Nell's going to put up with her, you know, put in a little dollop of here and do this that she has to edit because, A, the food's good. And B, she, you know, this is the woman that does the classifieds for her.
Right.
And does a pretty good job of it.
What a combination.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can tell you, you get all that stuff about, you know, I speak from bitter personal experience, but you get all that stuff about being a widow perfectly right.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of intense feeling for one person to go through.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's that sense there was a person there. You know, this person was in your life in every bit, little bit. You went to the grocery store, you bought pickles because they like it. And then you suddenly look at that jar in the refrigerator and you realize no one's going to eat those again.
Yeah.
No one in this household. And it's all those little things. And, you know, I think we're both old enough that we've gone through losses. We've gone through times when a person we thought would be there isn't going to be there. And I think, again, that's one of the things in life is how do we as people deal with those moments of loss, of grief, and how do we learn to move forward? How do we learn to carry that grief in a way that doesn't take away from the life we still have?
Well, that's what's great about Mickey and Nell. They're both moving on. So poised for new beginnings.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, again, they're in transition. And someday, you know, if I ever get to the point when I write and they're kind of fat and happy and sitting on the porch and holding someone's hand, that's probably going to be the end of the series because where else do you go from there?
Exactly. I'm glad you've thought this through. We've been talking with Jean Redmond, whose new J.M. Redmond novel is The Girl on the Edge of Summer. And she also has a new R. Jean Reed novel, Perdition. You can meet her Thursday, June 15th from 5 to 7 at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. Jean, thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's always great to talk to you.
Bad things happen to you, babies all the time. They laugh at who kisses them. Time's nine, but they cry. Who said babies never die? They cry. Who said babies never die?
You've probably read Ada Calhoun's essays in the Modern Love or Lives columns of the New York Times and thought, I should email that to a friend. Or clip it to save, if anybody does that anymore. Or maybe you read her first book, St. Mark's Place is Dead, a history of the legendary neighborhood in Manhattan's East Village. Today, we'll be talking about her new book, Wedding Toast I'll Never Give. Ada Calhoun, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
So here we are in peak wedding season, and you've come up with a perfect wedding present. Brilliant.
Thank you.
And it all grew out of a single essay, The Wedding Toast I'll Never Give, which was published in 2015. Tell us about that.
That's right. Yes, I wrote it when I was in Minneapolis, and I was at a conference, and my husband and son were supposed to join me, and my husband screwed up the plane tickets costing us hundreds of dollars, and I was very unhappy with him. And it was right around the time we'd been going to a lot of very starry-eyed weddings where people were promising all kinds of things about how they would be each other's best friend every second forever and never let each other down. And I knew that that was probably not true. They would probably have fights just like I was having with my husband in that moment.
And I love it when you describe the toast at your own wedding and you say, I feared this would devolve into an open mic situation.
I really did. It was funny. We planned out. We're like, okay, we don't want it to take too long before people eat. So we'll just have like four short toasts. And it was like my father, my father-in-law, my aunt, you know, friends. But then somebody just like grabbed the microphone and like read a poem he'd written. He's, you know, lovely guy. But it definitely sort of had this feeling like this is going to get serious soon. We had to like, I went out to be like, you know, dinner time, everybody eat right now, hurry.
Well, it's just a wonderful idea. It's so interesting that we're so fascinated with marriage. We remain fascinated by it. And I think part of that is such a tantalizing combination of the public and the private, don't you think?
I think that's true. I think it's a really interesting institution, just the fact that it's lasted for thousands of years. And even though marriage rates are down, it's still the vast majority of us who will get married at some point or other.
And one of the things that strikes me about your book so strongly is that so much of marriage is about time. You talk about building a shared history, planning a future, and yet managing to stay in the moment. And that's quite a balancing act for all of us, I think.
I think that's really true. And I think that that is something that maybe we don't spend as much time in our usual wedding toasts and our usual conversations about marriage really honoring, is just the stick-to-itiveness involved in staying married, just the stubbornness and being able to weather things like fights or, you know, other problems. Just the idea that, you know, my mother, when I asked her, how do you stay married? Because she'd had a lot of problems. My parents had a lot of trouble, but they just celebrated their 43rd wedding anniversary. And I said, you know, how do you stay married? And she said, you don't get divorced.
Right.
And, you know, and I thought, oh, you're, you know, messing with me. But the more I've thought about it, the more I think that it is that it's just sticking around. It's putting in the time. And then you come out of it and you see what you've built.
And you got some other great advice from people. You genuinely sought advice, which I loved.
It's funny. I did, when I was working on the book, it's essays, you know, personal essays. It's mostly memoir, but I also read everything I could find about marriage. And I talked to about 100 people, I guess, who'd been married for a while just to see what they had to say. And it's funny, most of it was quite simple. My grandmother was with my grandfather for 61 years, and I asked her how she did it, and she said, be nice. That was like a two-word advice for me. And again, I thought it was pretty simple, but the more I thought about it, the more I think that that really is a big part of it. It's about acknowledging that here's you, here's me, here's the rest of the world, and this is us. And just seeing that this other person's feelings have value as much as your own, and that's what you're agreeing to when you get married, is that you'll take this person seriously and you'll take their feelings to heart in everything you do.
Well, I thought of this when I was reading your book. There's this wonderful folk artist in New Orleans who makes these signs that say, be nice or leave. And I thought, Ada Calhoun needs a sign that says, be nice, don't leave.
That's really funny. That's great. I should get that. It's funny. If that sign was posted in New York, I feel like nobody would be here. I feel like everybody would be gone.
So one of the best pieces of advice in this book is to stay married, embrace change. And that was recently published as one of the first excerpts for, you know, pre-publication publicity. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about some of the changes you've observed in your own life.
Sure. In that essay, it's funny, they excerpted the chapter and it was without the story around it, which I wound up working as a nurse over the summer at an old-timey camp, like one of these. It was an old schoolhouse and they'd converted it into a camp for children, and I wound up being the camp nurse. So I had to wear this like old-timey gown and a nurse's apron and my hair pinned back. And my husband really enjoyed it quite a bit. Like, you know, it was really sort of fun. And he actually, in that same summer, recorded this fake album for me, pretending to be like a British folk singer from the 80s. It's like, anyway, it was just this kind of ridiculous summer of role playing. And it made me start thinking that actually I've been so many different people in this marriage. You know, when we met, I had like short black hair, I chain smoked, I was this photographer in Texas, you know, and now I've got like long blonde hair and I'm a reporter. We live in Brooklyn. I'm a mother. And, you know, it made me realize that in the course of a long marriage, you're just a lot of people, and that time gives us variety. So when people say, oh, I'm so bored, how can you stand being with the same person for 50 years? You're not. You know, I say that spread out over the years, like I'm a harem. know, I've been like a 4 and a 14. I've been everything. And it's, you're a lot of different women for your husband in the course of a long marriage.
And you're even a lot of different people for your son. I mean, dressing up as a camp nurse, I swear, I admired that so much.
It was pretty fun, I have to say. It was a really super random summer, but it was very enjoyable.
I know. I spent many years as a witch on Halloween, and it was very satisfying to me. Now you sound
liberating, isn't it?
It is very liberating. Now, you sound as though writing this book made you appreciate your own marriage even more. And your husband, who's musician and performance artist Neil Medlin, and many people know him as Champagne Jerry, he sounds like excellent company. So what kind of agreement did you make about writing about your private life? Because you're very open about everything in this book, it seems.
Yeah. It is very candid about my marriage and all of the intricate details of everything from our sex life to our finances. Luckily, like you said, as a musician and performance artist and really very performative and kind of the best person you could be married to if you were writing a memoir, because he just wanted it to be sexier and funnier and more personal. Like, he really never said, take this out or tone this down once. I definitely showed it to him at various stages. He read it when I had a full draft, and then he read it, you know, a couple other times. And I gave him full freedom to strike things if he thought it was too much information or too personal, and he didn't. He had two notes for me, and one of them was that I sounded neurotic when I was talking about us buying a house. You know, like, well, the reason we could do it was this and this and this. He said, everybody in America owns property at some point. Don't be weird about it. So I cut a couple paragraphs. And then he said, write something nice about my penis. So I put a parenthetical in the book that says, Neil says I have to write something nice about his penis. He has a magnificent penis. And then that's it. So it's all of his editorial suggestions right there.
As a demand, that seems relatively minor to me.
I know.
But oh, kind of great at the same time. You know?
Exactly. It's true. It's true. Yeah.
Now, one of the things you do in this book that I love so much is that you talk about marriages that go all the way to the end of life and how moving those are. What was that like for you? Because you're young, you know?
Oh, bless you. I mean, I hadn't even really started to think so much about death and marriage until I was working on this book. And, you know, one of the people I interviewed who was a priest, he said, people just forget that we get old and we die and we don't want to die alone and we don't want to be old alone. And so, of course, when you're 20 and 30 and 40, you're attracted to all these people and you're like, why would I ever want to get married? And it does us well to think a little more long term and to think, you know, there are some very practical reasons for that because, you know, life is long and it can be quite lonely. So I think there's a reason for marriage that is something we don't talk about, which is that we die.
Exactly. Well, I think it's so interesting the way you look at your spouse, the way you look at your kid. You look at them and see them at all the stages you've been in each other's lives. You know, it's a continuum in so many ways.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think that there are certain things that I find a lot easier with my child than I do with my husband. So, you know, if my son is really mad at me and he's, oh, God, he's like being really grouchy and unpleasant, I can still kiss him on the head when I drop him off at school and say, have a great day. You know, I love you. And when my husband's being grouchy, I just, like, I'm so mad at him. Like, it's so hard for me to do the same thing with him that I do with my child. And I think one thing about working on the book was sort of trying to see why that is and try to work harder to have more empathy for my husband the way I do for my child.
Well, no matter what stage you're at in a relationship, you can learn a lot from this book. And you do end on a very hopeful note with a wedding toast you would actually give.
Yes. It's funny. My good friends of ours, they got married right as I was finishing this book, and bless their hearts for doing that, because I was there and I was, you know, in the crowd thinking, if I said anything, what would I say? And luckily, it really gave me this opportunity to think, after this whole year of working on this book and thinking about marriage so hard, that I would say things about how wonderful it is, how beautiful it is to get married, and that what they're doing is something that gives something to everybody in the room, that it reminds us all just why other people are important in our lives and why noticing these moments of connection is so valuable.
And they're such hopeful moments, which I think we all need in life, you know?
Now more than ever.
And I love, love the playlist, which includes the entire album of Lemonade. I mean... That would be good for a wedding reception.
Good.
Oh, we've been talking with Ada Calhoun, whose wonderful and thought-provoking essay collection is Wedding Toasts I'll Never Give. You can meet her Thursday, June 8th, when Room 220 presents her reading at the French Quarter Wedding Chapel, 333 Burgundy Street, with wedding cake. Ada, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Bloomsbury Publishing's boldly bookish young adult author tour comes to New Orleans Tuesday, June 6th. You can meet Tara Altobrando, author of The Possible, Sarah Tolzer, author of Song of the Current, Emery Lord, author of The Names They Gave Us, and Bridget Kemmerer, author of Letters to the Lost. That's Tuesday, June 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. Laura Cayouette discusses and signs The Hidden Huntsman, a Charlotte Reed mystery, Tuesday, June 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Abby Stern discusses and signs her novel According to a Source, Wednesday, June 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Lucy Lulu Buffett presents a tasting and discusses and signs Gumbo Love, Recipes for Gulf Coast Cooking, Entertaining, and Savoring the Good Life, Thursday, June 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Celebrate the new issue of Louisiana Cultural Vistas with food, drink, and disturbance. Columnist Allison Fensterstock interviews D. Eric Bookhart about the 60s counterculture rivalry between the Process Church and the Bodhisattva in the French Quarter. That's Thursday, June 8th from 6 to 9 at the New Orleans Pharmacy Museum, 514 Charters. Claire Daniel discusses and signs Mediating Morality, the Politics of Teen Pregnancy in the Post-Welfare Era. Thursday, June 8th at 6 at Octavia Books. Nick Maneri, author of The Infinite, Kent Wascom, author of The Blood of Heaven, and David Armand, author of My Mother's House, discuss their new books Thursday, June 8th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Ada Calhoun, reads from and signs Wedding Toasts I'll Never Give, Thursday, June 8th at 7, when Room 220 presents her reading at the French Quarter Wedding Chapel, 333 Burgundy Street, with wedding cake. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Super Sad True Love Story by Gary Steingart, Saturday, June 10th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Michael Quest Moore reads from his new book, Sleeper Cell, and presents a workshop Saturday, June 10th at 2 at Crescent City Books. Book artists Sarah White and Jessica Peterson use letterpress printing and handmade paper to craft limited edition handbound books on view in the exhibit Convergence, which opens Saturday, June 10th at 6 at Antenna Gallery. The exhibit runs through July 8th, Tuesdays through Sundays, noon to 5. James Farwell, Virginia Roddy, Yvonne Chalker, Jeffrey Elkins, and Gary Elkins discuss and sign their book, The Architecture of Cybersecurity, Sunday, June 11th from 3 to 4:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Delia Tomino Nakayama reads from her work and sings Sunday, June 11th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Kristen Sanders reads from her new poetry collection, Country, Sunday, June 11th at 5 at the Antenna Gallery on St. Claude. Pilot Erin Seideman appears for a discussion of her book, Postcards from the Sky, Monday, June 12th at 6 at the Collins Hotel with the NOLA Lit Book Club. And today's guest, Jean Redman, signs Girl on the Edge of Summer and Perdition, her two new mysteries, Thursday, June 15th from 5 to 7 at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.